We're in round two with Bildad making his second assault. It is so hard to follow this and get an idea of even how long it took. And the best example I could think of is if we each took a part, you know, one person plays Job and three people play his friends, and then we just sit and we read like we were all sitting around in a circle, and we read it, and that's how long it took. This whole 35 chapters in the middle, that's how long it took. They just answer one another right one after the other. And so when we take it apart chapter by chapter, you really lose that, but there's no other way to do it. I mean, it would take hours if we just sat and went all the way through it. So I don't know if you can remember, we ended last week with Job answering Eliphaz, who was the oldest, and you'd see the Job's so-called friends who ostensibly came to comfort him, and they wind up accusing him, and they just won't let it go. We said last week that when God allows the same kind of attack to happen over and over and over, and I'm saying, oh, please give me a break, please give me a break, so I have come to realize that sometimes the reason he doesn't take it away is that when I resist, I get stronger. And the more Job answers their accusations, which are not true, that he's a wicked sinner and this whole thing is his fault and he's insulting God by not admitting that he's a hypocrite, the more he defends himself, it's not affecting them. But have you noticed that he seems to be getting stronger? I think one of the most... one of the strongest affirmations of Job happens in chapter 19 tonight. That's why we sang that song, I Know My Redeemer Lives. Job said it at the lowest point in his life. And that's another reason why this story is recorded for us. Can I just read something that Pastor Chuck wrote? I just thought it was so good. I just made a copy of it. Speaking of the repetition, why did God just allow this whole debate to be recorded? It just seems to go on and on and on. Patricia pointed out something last Tuesday up in Rockland. She said, you know, but that's the reality when we're going through a hard trial. You know, it just keeps, it's like waves. It just keeps coming on you. And when you defend yourself and you hang on to something and you're afloat for a while, another wave comes and you lose your grip. And she said, that's life. That's the way the really hard trials are. And so we get some kind of an idea experiencing what Job, though we don't feel the pain and discomfort and loss and grief that he was feeling, we can feel a little bit of how he must feel being surrounded by people that should be acting like friends, and they're instead making his problem worse. Let me hear you read to you what Pastor Chuck said. He says, why does the Lord belabor this so much? Why all of this repetition? Why is it recorded? Because there are still people around that are that stupid today, like Job's comforters. There are still people who think this way. They still that if you get in trouble, they'll come around and say, well, brother, why don't you repent? You know, so you can be prosperous. Why don't you forsake your sin? Because surely if you're good, God's going to prosper you. And if you're evil, you're going to be cut off. But that is simply not true. Righteous people sometimes suffer, and evil people sometimes prosper. Righteous people sometimes prosper, and evil people sometimes suffer. We just don't know why righteous people oftentimes suffer. We don't know. It's wrong to assume things about a person just because he's suffering. It's wrong to assume that a person doesn't have faith and that's why he's sick. It's wrong to assume that if you just had enough faith, you'd never be sick, because that just isn't so. I wrote in parentheses that innocuous little scripture in the Old Testament that said, and Elisha fell sick of the illness from which he died. Elisha, who had a double portion of the Spirit of God over Elijah, the man of faith. And he got sick and he died from it. Too bad, Elisha, you didn't have enough faith to confess that away. It just doesn't hold water, that whole line of thinking. God allows this point to be pressed over and over from several different directions in order to show the folly of seeking with our human wisdom and our human understanding to try to find out the ways and the reasons and the whys of God. I don't have to understand the whys. All I have to understand is the fact that God is in control, and I rest there, that God controls the affairs of my life. More than once, we have seen Job come to that place of rest. And so I've got a ways to go before I'm going to get through this. A lot of us going to sound familiar. Bildad, remember when he came on the scene in his first volley, Eliphaz had already come along, sort of blew Job away, because Job, they all just sat there for a whole week and didn't say anything. And then when they spoke, Eliphaz just attacked him and said, well, you know, this kind of stuff that happened to you only happens to wicked people. So, you know, we're your friends. Maybe you should just confess to that wickedness. And you can just see Job stunned by this. And so his first answer to Eliphaz, he says, no, there's nothing between me and the Lord. And then Bildad jumps in and says, now, how dare you say that God was not being fair by claiming that you have nothing between you and God? Obviously you do. So your problem is not just that you're a sinner. Your problem is that you're a hypocrite about it as well. You're pretending you're not. And Job tries to defend himself against that. And then Zophar comes along, and Zophar says, you know, you probably didn't get as bad as you deserve. And poor Job. Then Eliphaz comes back. Job is astonished that Eliphaz comes back and repeats the very same thing that he said before. One of the last things he said to this guy, he says, when are you guys going to shut up? You know, isn't it bad enough? I'm suffering. Why do you have to keep going? What's your possible motive? Remember he said last week, what's the possible motive you could have for continuing to pound on me? So that's what we're left with. As Bildad steps in again, he's still singing the same tune. Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, in essence, when will you shut up? I read one commentator that said, if you have ever seen Middle Eastern people having this kind of a discussion, they don't do it in dulcet tones. They yell at each other. Their faces get red. They pound on the table. And that's something I had never thought of in this thing. But when you look at the language that they're using, they just get, even Job gets irritated, and I don't blame him. How long till you put an end to words, or when will you shut up? Bildad says, get a brain, and afterwards we'll speak, is essence what he says. Gain understanding. Get a clue. Get on the clue bus, Job, and then we can talk. Why are we counted as beasts and regarded as stupid in your sight? Don't you bet there was egg on their face when God steps in at, you know, chapter 37, and God steps in and says, you guys, you are stupid. You were wrong. Oh boy, I hope they learned their lesson. You who tear yourself in anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or shall the rock be removed from its place? Remember, there, the point of view that all three of these guys are coming from is that everybody knows we're older than you. Last time, Eliphaz says, we're older than your dad. We're smarter than you, and the people who taught us, everybody knows that bad stuff happens to bad people and good stuff happens to good people. Therefore, bad stuff happened to you. Therefore, you must be a bad person. And that's the same thing he's saying. Well, you know, you're getting all uppity in your anger, but do you think the facts are going to change just for you? Thing is, they aren't the facts. I better get going. back in chapter 17, in the last speech that Job made, he said, you know what? My days are extinguished. They're snuffed out. Listen to what Bildad says here in verse 5. The light of the wicked indeed goes out, and the flame of his fire does not shine. Now, everything that he's going to say for the rest of this chapter is summed up in verse 21, where he's describing the way of the wicked man, and he uses, I think, very cruel statements in here to say, Job, it's you. You're a wicked man, obviously. So the light is dark in his tent, verse 6. His lamp beside him is put out. The steps of his strength are shortened, and his own counsel casts him down or trips him up. He is cast into a net by his own feet. He walks into a snare, and a net takes him by the heel, and a snare lays hold of him. And again, talking about the wicked man, but basically saying, Job, this is all your fault. This is what happens to wicked people. Terrors frighten him on every side and drive him to his feet. And one commentator I read said that means that when you're sitting comfortably, and the next thing you're so afraid that you jump to your feet and run away. His strength is starved, and destruction is ready at his side. Listen to the things that he says, and then remember the description of Job's bodily illnesses. He couldn't eat. He couldn't sleep. He had horrible lesions on his skin. So listen to what he says. His strength is starved. Destruction is ready at his side. Verse 13, Bildad says, it devours patches of his skin. The firstborn of death devours his limbs. He's uprooted from the shelter of his tent. Remember, Job wasn't living at home. He couldn't live at home. He was sitting on the ash heap at the town dump. And they parade him before the king of terrors. They dwell in his tent who are none of his. In other words, other people are living in his house. Brimstone is scattered on his dwelling. His roots are dried out below, and his branch withers above. The memory of him perishes from the earth, and he has no name among the renowned. The implication in Hebrew is that he used to be renowned, but when he's shown for being a wicked man, he's not renowned anymore. He's driven from light into darkness. That was one of the last things Job said in verse 17. Chased out of the world. He has neither son nor posterity among his people, nor any remaining in his dwellings. Those are just rude, cruel words to talk to somebody who's had all this happen to them and then say, this is your fault. You walked into the snare yourself. This is what happens to wicked people. Those in the West are appalled at his day. Those in the East are frightened. That's Hebrew poetry, once again, contrast and repetition. You're going to see the word astonished 3 or 4 times in these chapters. When it's used positively, it means the way we would talk about astonished as amazed. When it's used negatively, it means appalled. And that's the way it's used in all of these usages. Verse 21, surely such are the dwellings of the wicked man, and this is the place of him who does not know God, literally who does not recognize or acknowledge God. And once again, that was Bildad's primary accusation, and he's still holding on to it. You just won't admit that you're a sinner and that God is just in judging you. And that's still his position. And it will be his position for, you know, a few more chapters, which takes place over a few more hours until God steps in and corrects the record. So Job answered, chapter 19, how long will you torment my soul and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you've reproached me, and you are not ashamed that you've hardened yourselves and wronged me. If I indeed have erred, my error remains with me. In other words, it's my problem. Why would you even care? Why pound it home to me? If this was all my fault because I'd made a mistake, that's between me and God. If indeed you exalt yourselves against me and plead my disgrace against me, in other words, saying that it's my fault, know then that God has overthrown me and put me in the wrong and has surrounded me with his net. In other words, God did this, I didn't do it. Now remember, last time, Job got a clue that maybe it wasn't God, that maybe it was Satan. God would have had to allow it, but at least he, I don't know if this has ever happened to you when you're going through something just extremely difficult. You have moments of lucidity, moments of clarity where you see the truth and you hang on to it. I think of it as flotsam. You hang on to it and it keeps you from sinking, but the next assault, the next wave, that you lose your grip on it. At the worst times in my life, God has had to repeat himself over and over and over because I just couldn't hang on to it. That's the thing I see happening here with Job. Job's back to God's the one that did this. But it's not true. It wasn't God at all. Verse 7, if I cry out concerning wrong, I'm not heard. Is that true? Well, it was true that his friends weren't hearing him, what he was saying. But it wasn't true that God wasn't hearing him. Please hold this thought. God is always hearing you. That's why we sang that song. He knows my name. He knows my every, I can't remember the lyrics now, thought. He always hears me when I call. Does he always answer me immediately? No, he doesn't. But it doesn't mean he doesn't hear. And of course, the minute I think that I need to hear immediately back, like Jimmy said today, the minute I think I need to get some kind of a thing that will make me feel like my prayers are have hit the mark, and God delays in saying anything or doing anything, the lies will flow like wine because I'm very vulnerable in those minutes. And we've seen Job wrestling with that. Verse 7.5, if I cry aloud, there is no justice. And I wrote in the margins, not yet, Job. Once again, he's about a half a day away from all of this whole thing going away. In 140 more years in his life. Remember, Job thinks he's going to die. He thinks this is the end of his life and he's going to go out without even having a chance to talk to God. Remember a few chapters ago, he said, if I could just talk to God. Maybe God does think I'm a sinner, but though he slay me, I will still hope in him. He's saying, if I just wish I could talk to him. If I could talk to him and I walked into his presence, you know, yeah, he could kill me if he wanted to, but I'm still going to put my hope in him. When I hear that statement out of Job's lips, and of course, God's keeping his mouth shut, but I bet there was a really big smile on his face. You can almost see him looking over at the devil saying, what do you think? You said this guy would curse me to my face. Look at him. He thinks I'm doing this to him, and he's still going to put his hope in me. We talked this tonight, Wayne and I were talking about, and Mary, talking about the scripture in Ephesians that says that our lives of trusting God are not just played for an earthly audience, they're also played for a heavenly audience. We praise God by trusting in him. But Job, he still doesn't get it. Verse 8, he can't hang on to it. He has moments. Verse 8, he has fenced up my way so that I cannot pass. That was true. Job was trapped, but it was only temporary. Once again, the two of maybe the most important things to remember about the book of Job is that for the godly person, all suffering is temporary. I think you could add a corollary onto that and say all confusion is temporary. Because we're going to know everything someday. we're going to see why it all, how it all makes sense. The other thing that is important to glean from the book of Job is that all disappointment with God is premature. You can't really be disappointed with God until the story's over. And then when the story's over, we're not going to be disappointed with God. We're going to be giving him a standing ovation, saying, what a brilliant way to do that, when we've been whining and complaining like Job. It's going to be interesting. God never really blames Job for all of this struggle. But when Job finally hears what God has to say, Job just said, I stink. I am vile. I am a vile stinker. And I don't know anything. But God doesn't upbraid him for it, which I find comforting. Some of God's very best friends acted just like this. God has fenced up my way temporarily, and he has set darkness in my path. In other words, I can't see the way out of this. And it's because God has made it too dark to see. Now, the next four verses, he's going to say he five times. And I put a little F besides everyone because it's all false. It's not God doing this. He has stripped me of my glory. Now, remember last time we saw Job, when he had this glimpse that it was the devil, when he said he was talking about Satan. Here he's still gone back to that it's God. He stripped me of my glory, taken the crown from my head. By the way, he was going to get his glory back very shortly. He breaks me down on every side and I'm gone. Not God. My hope he has uprooted like a tree. Don't you just want to say, Job, couple of more hours, buddy. Couple of more hours and you are never going to be without hope for the rest of your life. If you could just see past this, you could have hope even now. And of course, we're going to, if I ever get there, we're going to read one of the most amazing statements of hope anybody ever made in verse 25. Verse 11, he has also kindled his wrath against me, and he counts me as one of his enemies. Is that true? No, it is not. In fact, just the opposite. God challenges Satan, saying, look throughout the whole earth, but this guy, this is my favorite guy. There's nobody like him. That's about the opposite of considering him your enemy. I often wonder, folks, when the devil's lying and he's telling you that you stink, and or he's telling me that I stink, and God is letting us defend ourselves simply by trusting in him, and he hasn't spoken up like he didn't speak up with Job. I wonder if at those moments when we trust him without the strokes and the reinforcement, I wonder if we bless his heart maybe more, if he looks at us and boasts about our trust in him the way he did for Job and counts us as one of his friends. Verse 12, his troops come together and build up their road against me. They encamp all around my tent. Remember when we were at Masada and we saw this fortress that, 1,200 feet above the valley floor, and when the Romans came to besiege it, they weren't in a hurry. They built this unbelievable ramp out of dirt, and they didn't have steam shovels and bulldozers. They hauled it bucket by bucket by bucket, and they built a ramp up 1,200 feet to get up there with their engines and bust the walls down. And that's the language that Job is saying. This is what God's done to me. But once again, Job, it's not God. He's removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed me. My close friends have forgotten me. Those who dwell in my home and my maidservants count me as a stranger. Don't miss that statement. Those who dwell in my home. Job's not dwelling in his home at this point. He's kicked out of his own house. But the very people that used to be his servants that are living in his house treat him like a stranger. By the way, as I'm looking through these six verses talking about his family, did God alienate them from him? No, they had a choice. Even these three guys, they had a choice. They could have come close to their friend. They could have kept their mouths shut. They could have just listened and comforted him. They alienated themselves. Don't fall for that lie. And if you do, you wouldn't be the first one. David fell for it all the time. When he thought, nobody cares about me, nobody cares about me. And he thought that it was God. But people are given a free will. That's why I think when stuff like this happens is when you find out who your real friends are. They're the ones that don't forsake you. Verse 16, I call my servant, but he gives no answer. I beg him with my mouth. I love verse 17. It's an idiom, but it's hilarious. My breath is offensive to my wife. It's the way my New King James renders it. But it is an idiom. It literally means I'm repulsive. But my breath, meaning the very fact that I'm alive and breathing, is offensive to my wife. And I scratched out the entire second half of that verse because the translation that I have here just doesn't even come close to the Hebrew. I've read about eight different texts, and just let me read you the one that makes the most sense, because I want to talk about it. I'm repulsive to my wife, or my breath is offensive to my wife, is the idiom. Though I implore her for the sake of our children, the children of my own body. That's the closest to the Hebrew. Once again, Job is a hard book to translate. The smartest people that I know in the resources that I look at, they all say, this is just difficult. It's poetry. It's hard. It's also the first book in the Bible that was written. So when we're looking for the meaning of idioms, we don't have anything to compare it to sometimes, because everything else follows on the heels. But let me just consider that translation, which most of the resources that I've read believe that is the correct, that I'm repulsive to my wife, though I implore her, I plead with her for the sake of our children, the children of my own body. Let me just throw this out to you, because I've been pondering this. Have you ever known somebody, a married couple, whose child dies? And one of the things that happens is that in order to deal with their grief, they blame each other. I've seen it happen many, many times. I've seen some marriages that don't survive the death of a child, or even the injury of a child. Now, to be fair to Job's wife, she lost all seven of her kids too. Here's what I wonder. I wonder if she's hearing this entire conversation from these respected friends, and that the thought has come on her, maybe this is Job's fault.